We'll have two ripe NCC status reports. Then we'll hear something about DNS MODA, which is not another DNS record type, but something Jim Reed will present. Quad A measurements, reverse delegation 6 to 4, and finally, I guess Olaf is talking about delegations. Andre, sorry, I mixed that up. Okay, I'm sorry. Be careful what you say, I said. Okay, as always, we have this white blue sheet, and I'd like to circulate it. Please state your name and affiliation, and you will be part of the lottery. You win a free domain in .eu. Okay, Sam, please go ahead. And we have a tight agenda, so 15 minutes.
How about I make this do what I want? All right. Last ITF meeting was in Seoul. It was very, very boring. DNSX didn't meet. DNS Ops only met half the time they had reserved. The next meetings are both in the United States. The second one is after the U.S. visit program happens for the visa waiver countries, which means you're going to get photographed and fingerprinted. If you don't like this, you might want to tell the ITF secretariat to quit having meetings in the United States. I personally don't like it, and I have to live there. So what actually happened in Seoul? In DNS Op, which is the only one that met, DNS Discovery, the working group has been, for V6, the working group has been stalled on for quite some time. There are a number of competing proposals and no consensus. So the ISG has said, you will produce a document comparing these alternatives, and you will deliver it to us no later than August, or we're just going to forget about this. We're going to remove the comparison item from your charter. We're going to remove all of this V6 DNS discovery stuff from your charter. And we might reopen it later, but it seems very unlikely. The other thing that happened purely at Seoul was that a draft previously rejected by the working group was submitted as an individual submission to the RFC editor. Working group was asked for input. No one had any. So DNS Ops has made a bit of progress. They have several drafts in working group last call. They have one draft in ITF last call. Some of these down here at the bottom have actually expired. The DNS Ops working group only has 6 active drafts right now, including DNSSEC operational practices, Olaf. One up from the bottom, bad DNS res is resolver misbehavior. That draft is sorely lacking for review. The chairs have asked for comments. There are also a bunch of drafts in DNS op that have gone absolutely nowhere, mostly for lack of editorial attention. One of those was assigned a new editor. That would be the inadder required. There was a question raised in Seoul about whether the interim signed root draft should just be killed or should some attempt should be made to revive it. No input was offered at the time. Everything else there was generally blamed on lack of editorial attention. Most of the document authors were not in Seoul. DNSX, again, which didn't meet, is actually in pretty good shape. There are 9 open drafts. 3 of them are at the RFC editor. One of them is an IETF last call, and the 3 DNSSEC BizDocs, I'm told, are going to have a new revision released very soon and then go into working group last call. Those are the 7 of 9 that are the DNSSEC documents. The wonderful thing here is that we have not discovered any major protocol issues in about the last year. And all of the issues that have been discovered that we tried to fix with little drafts, like the type code role, all those drafts are going through. And there are two other open drafts that no one's paying that much attention to. What's left for DNSX? Most of the milestones in the charter are advancing existing RFCs to draft. One of those, the unknown type support RFC, Jakob is coordinating the interoperability testing. If you have an implementation, if you want to contribute some resources to that, talk to Jakob. Yes. No, there's a mailing list. It was posted to name droppers. If anyone can't find that, ask someone.
We can include that in the minutes, I guess.
Absolutely. That's all. Questions?
Okay, thank you. So the next one is David Knight with an update on KRoot.
Hi, good morning. I'm going to give a status update on what we've been doing with KRoot since the last time I presented, which was, I think, last September. At that time, we'd deployed our first Anycast instance in Amsterdam, and we're still investigating what we were going to do in regard to our local node model. Since then, we've done that, and we've now deployed our first two local nodes in Frankfurt in January, and Athens in April. In fact, the Athens one came online just at the start of last week. The only other thing really we have to report at the moment is we've just made an update to our website. Made a prettier picture on the front page, all nicely clickable, and moved our statistics and things for each instance into its own page. Basically just to tidy up our front page, which was beginning to become a bit messy. But there then you can find statistics per instance, information about the hosts, what id.server each instance will respond to when queried, routing information, things like that. In the next few weeks, we do intend to add more to this website, some more statistics, things like that. So I said that last time we spoke, we were still putting together our local node package. Since then, we've deployed two. Our package, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but essentially this is what we do. This is very like our global node, but the local node package just has less stuff in it. But we have a router, a switch, servers, and some management equipment. Internally inside each node, we do load balancing with OSPF. We announce the KRoot prefix into an internet exchange point. We take address space from the host aggregate for administration purposes. It's, I guess, pretty much like what others are doing. Since last time, our query load aggregated across all of our KRoot instances is up to 7,000 queries a second. On average over a month, from about 5,500 last September. Our current distribution of that, naturally we see most of that at the two global nodes. And in Athens, we've only been online for a week. We haven't got a lot of peerings yet, so we're still not seeing a lot of queries there. I think it's on the order of about 20 a second at the moment. Now that we're actively deploying our local nodes, we start to think about deploying further global nodes. Our intention here is to put two somewhere in North America and another two somewhere in Asia. We currently have two in Western Europe. And of course, we're continuing to deploy further local instances. We just made an agreement that we're going to go to Qatar, and we have, I think, three or four which are in the final stages of agreement, which we'd expect to deploy in the coming couple of months. The last time I spoke here, we had plans to deploy IPv6. We put that on hold, but now we've completed our testing of that, and we intend, following a hardware upgrade in Amsterdam, to go live with that during the course of the next month or so. If you want to peer with us, currently we're peering at the AMSIX, the NLIX exchange point, and the DASIX. You can contact us at kpeering@rout.net. If you're interested in hosting, if you look at the Kroot servers or website, there's a document there describing guidelines for expressions of interest for hosting, and also information and statistics are there as well. Are there any questions?
For the benefit of those on the webcast, this is Jabit. Yeah. My question is, when you've started to deploy these other instances of the Kroot server, have you started doing any kind of traffic analysis yet? Let me give you an example of what I mean. If you find that, for instance, you've got an instance of the Kroot server in Athens, are you finding that most of the traffic that's coming to that server is primarily from Greece? And are you finding Greek networks which are popping up with traffic to, let's say, the instance in Amsterdam or in London, rather than the one in Athens, that might indicate some kind of peering or routing problem?
Well, the way the model works is when we go into an exchange, we're announcing the prefix with no export. So only those networks connected to the exchange and perhaps their downstream customers, if they choose to override this to give it to them, will see the node. As far as looking at traffic on the global nodes to see that we are getting traffic there that we should be getting elsewhere, no, we haven't done anything in that area yet.
Okay, are there any plans to do that?
We do have a plan to begin looking at more advanced monitoring and statistics gathering, but we haven't worked out the specifics of just what information we're going to gather there. Okay. We need to look at
time scales.
We plan to make a start on that, I think, during the next. Right now, we are focusing our efforts on deploying further local mirror instances. But probably on the order of 2 months from now, we probably get stuck into that.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? No? So thanks, David. And the next speaker is Olaf with an update on the reverse project.
I have to find this. Okay. This is an update on the reverse DNS project. It's probably, this is essentially an update on the major milestone which we met. You might have seen me before talking about the reverse delegation project. What is it? Well, we identified a number of problems when we started looking on how to deploy DNSSEC in the reverse tree. We sort of revisited our provisioning system and looked at all the problems that our users have when dealing with updating the reverse tree. One of the things that we found is that users would like to have more fine-grained control over who updates the reverse DNS or who creates delegations for their network space. Previously, you had to be a local IR. You had to have access to your RegID, and the authorization was essentially based on that. And we wanted to give more flexibility there. We also had only one interface to submit the data to, which was the auto-inetter robot. And the back end of the auto-inetter robot is that it essentially the robot was called Marvin. Marvin would update the zone files and then update the database. Now, some people did also update their objects through their domain objects through the WHIS database. Now, a direct update of the WHIS database would not end up in the zone files, and that led to inconsistencies and, I mind you, confusion. We also wanted to give access to all kinds of other interfaces that we have been developing for the WIS database, async update, web updates, and of course the mail update. So the idea here is to make the WIS database the preferred interface, and the WIS database has multiple ways to update it, for submitting domain objects. There was also inconsistency in the policy. The policy essentially said if you have an allocation size smaller than /16, you have to have a valid assignment for the /24 you requested delegation for. If you had an allocation size bigger than a /16, so a /15 or so, you could immediately request reverse delegation for the /16. That is confusing and inconsistent. So we simplified the policy as well. And the idea was to allow the implementation of a DNSSEC key exchange based on the way you do business with us today. What's the status? Well, essentially, the prerequisite for going to the WIS database as the preferred interface for doing your reverse DNS management was that the data that was in the database needed to be consistent with the data that was in our zone files. We did a consistency cleanup. We warned people in the beginning of this year that was coming, the people for which that was relevant, and we cleaned the data up where the DNS had the preference. And since April 26, last week, we have the new interface and the policy operational. And Marvin, the old system, you can still use it, but it will be disabled as per July 1, 2004. DNSSEC implementation has been deferred. The current thought, however, is to use the domain object and introduce a DNS key attribute which is used to upload your key, and the authorization of that is based on the same way you can do your upload your delegation information, so set which name service we have to delegate to. This is a little embarrassing, but let me get to the embarrassing part in a bit. The cleanup of the inconsistencies, as I said, that's a prerequisite for using the WIS database for generating zone files. We wanted to switch over at the moment that the switch over would essentially be transparent to the user, so we first had to clean up the data. What we did is when there was a conflict between what was in the DNS, the name servers that were in the DNS and the name servers that were listed in the domain object, is that we said the DNS is operational data. It's used. People do the tree nowadays. We'll take the data that is in the DNS as a preference. We did specifically not do a lameness check. If the data was lame while being in the DNS, we did not clean up the lameness. So if it pointed to the wrong set of NS servers, then we did not correct that. But what we did correct is that the data about the wrong name servers is now both in the DNS and in the WIS database. To be clear. The embarrassing part is that when I prepared the slides, I didn't have the statistics at hand, and I said, and domain objects were modified, and domain to be filled in later. Now, I forgot to fill this in, but the overall number of modifications in the database based on this is in the order of about 12,000 updates. So 12,000 domain objects were modified, where modified means also that a deletion could have happened, because that's essentially added a deleted line to the object. The exact details I can mail to the list if that is needed, but I don't have them at hand now, so that's the embarrassing part. The new policy. The most important policy change is that we sort of simplified it even more than it used to be. The only thing that you need is you only need to have an allocation. As soon as you have an allocation for a part of outer space, you can set up the reverse DNS. There is no need for an assignment any longer. And previously, the policy used to read that you had to be a local IR to request reverse delegation. That has been loosened up a bit as well. It now says that if you are authorized by an address block user, you can request reverse delegation, which is handy. That means you can delegate the responsibility for maintaining your reverse delegation to a third party that is not necessarily a local IR. And the way that is implemented, I get to, which is the MNT domain's attribute in the domain object, but that comes later. What is the request procedure? Just as a simple overview, not much changed. Essentially, you have to set up your zones, you have to set up your DNS correctly. Then you fill in the domain object template, just like you did before. One little change is that you now have to put a maintain by attribute in. So your object needs to have a maintainer. That is essentially because maintain none was obsoleted, and we actually want everybody to maintain their objects. You have to make sure that object is properly authorized, and this is the main difference with Marvin. The authorization comes from the names, from the number space, so to speak, and not from having a regID in the header of the mail. And then you use one of the Whois databases. Most people will use probably the email interface to submit that domain object. You can also use a web update program. We have this little tool on the web with which you can fill in domain templates or other database templates, and you can use that to set up your objects and submit them. What is done is essentially if you want to put the delegation in place for /24, the code looks up the closest less specific inetnum object, so say a /20 or so inet object, and it will essentially look at the maintainers in that object specified by that object to see if the domain object maintainer is authorized to do the creation of the delegation. And only if that inetnum-based authorization fails, then the less specific domain is used for the update. So then we fall back to the normal database operations to look at the less specific object in the object hierarchy. How does this work? Essentially, so you take the most less specific INET, how did we say that? The closest less specific INET object, and first you're going to check if there's an empty domains, which points to the maintainer that creates the domain object. If that is there, then that maintainer is allowed to do the delegation. And essentially this attribute allows you to say somebody else here, somebody else, another entity is allowed to create delegations for me, which is a good thing. You can sort of outsource that information to a third party. In the absence of the MNT domains, a fallback is done to the maintain lower. The reason for doing that is to maintain backwards compatibility. If you now submit your objects to Marvin, and you want to switch immediately to the AutoDBN, we want to have as little failure states as possible. And most people will have an MNT lower in their INETNUM object that they also use for the maintaining other objects, such as the domain object. At least they probably have access to that. If there's no maintain lower, we use to maintain by. So this is the RPSL fallback mechanism, essentially. As a consequence, local IRs will, in most cases, be able to request a delegation without any special preparation. If you use the auto inetter interface now and you make a transition to the auto DBM interface, you probably get through it. But the MNT domains allows for flexibility, and there are special cases where you will have to add an MNT domain because you're essentially blocked by an object that is owned by an organization to which you made an assignment. Let me explain. If you look at the /19 allocation, that has a maintain lower by A. Now imagine that middle block is not there, the /22 assignment. And I, as a local IR who has access to the maintainer A, want to create a delegation for the /24 because I maintain the reverse space for my customers. Then that is what I do today. I'm authorized today to create that domain. And I would upload my domain with the authorization based on A. Now I have made an assignment to a /22 assignment to a customer. That customer gets its own maintainer for that specific object. Now, you can see there is no, imagine there would be no MNT domains. Then if I would submit the /24 domain object, then there is no maintained domains in the /22. There is no maintained lower in the /22. So the MNT by is used. MNT by B would be used to authorize the upload. Essentially, that means that the /22 object, INETNUM object, would block the local IR from submitting the object and creating the delegation. The solution now is that the /19 allocation owner, the local IR, has to talk to their customers and ask them to put in an MNT domains A to allow the local IR to keep maintaining the reverse DNS. With modification, essentially the usual DB rules applies. You look at the MNT by attribute of the domain object itself. Any update will provoke DNS checks. So even if you update the taxi or the admin C, you go through the DNS checks and your object might be bounced if they don't succeed. For deleting, usual DB rules, but there is an INETNUM override. Essentially, the owner of the closest less specific INETNUM can always delete the domain object. So the owner of the address space can delete the reverse delegation. Makes sense to me. Backend processing. Once stuff is in the database, once domain objects are in the database, we pick them up by a process. Essentially, all updates are sent through to this process. They will transform the objects into information that goes into the zone files, and essentially updates appear about every 15 minutes. If there is a failure, it may take up to 2 hours. If it takes longer than 2 hours, we might have a problem. So that is a sort of the timescale in which things appear in the DNS. In case that NS.Ripe.net is a secondary, it needs to be a secondary, and that's if you have a slash 16 domain object, then you have to make sure that the SOA mname field is reachable for our networks. And what we do essentially is we look up the IP address of that mname field, and that's put in our named.conf. If you renumber your primary server, so the mname field is associated with the server in the mname field is associated with a new IP address, then we will catch that at some point. If you want to enforce the update of that IP address, you have to send a no operation update, and then the thing will happen automatically. The transition now is that AutoDBM, as of now, essentially is the preferred interface for submitting your domain objects. And we're going to get rid of the AutoNetArrive.net interface, the old Marvin interface, by July 1. So you have some time to change your software to test your procedures against the new system, but we really want to get rid of that old interface to make sure there's no confusion. The code is frozen, so we don't make modifications and such. The new policy, by the way, is not fully implemented. You still have to do, if you use the old interface, you should use your old methods like you previously did. If you see problems, and there are a few children diseases, so to speak, mainly reports that do not really make sense to end users, where we can improve, please send your mails to RipeDBM. So, essentially, this is what I talked about. We have a new, more flexible interface, we think, for you as customers. The data in this database is now completely consistent with the data in the DNS, which helps with troubleshooting. And any new interface that will be developed for the WHIS database will also be available for updating the reverse DNS. So that gives you flexibility on how to implement your provisioning, so to speak. That's it.
Okay, thanks, Olaf. Any questions?
Jim Reed again. Not a question so much about this. Are there any plans to introduce T6 to restrict or control access for the zone transfers when ns.write.net is acting as a slave server for universe zone?
That's a request.
No, I'm just asking you if there's any plan, if there's any plan or any discussion about this, or is this something that our working group should be making some recommendations to Ripe NCC that T6 should maybe be introduced on transfers of the reverse zones?
There has not been any plan along those lines. So if this working group thinks this is useful, then...
Could I ask the meeting for a quick show of hands? So does anybody care about this? Would it be a good idea to have transaction signatures on the zone transfers for the Ripe reverse in Aberdour tree?
With all the...
Or to have the option of having the option of being able to use T-SIG on those zone transfers. Who would like to see that?
1, 2, 3. Okay.
Who would not like to see that? Okay. So...
Why not? Because what is the reason to have zone transfer restrictions on the reverse tree, which is pretty structured? Zone transfer restrictions are useless anyway for most of the zones. Okay.
This is probably not about zone transfer restrictions, but
about authenticity.
Yeah, integrity.
Yes, I'm not talking about restrictions. I'm talking about signing the zone transfers.
Okay.
Because the restriction you can do IP based, and essentially we publish the address space from which we pull the zone.
Anyway, okay. So, would anyone volunteer to take that to the list? You showed your hand. No, I volunteer you. Could you send?
Please supply a suggestion on how to do the symmetric key.
You're being evil.
I know, but this is essentially the problem that needs to be solved before we can do the implementation.
Can we take that to the list, because we're roughly running out of time?
To be honest, I would love to see 6.0 be used for that. That would ease.
Okay. Can we have another action item on Olaf? Yes, this is one. The first action item, a second one on you. You talked about reviewing the checks you perform. Could you just post a summary of what is being done at the moment, or a point to the documentation? Okay. So thanks, Olaf, again. And the next speaker is Jim, talking about DNS Moda. Whatever that might be.
This presentation is potentially controversial, so
controversially said.
Yes, I expect to have more time for questions for the actual presentation itself, and I should hopefully have my suit of protective armour when you start throwing rotten fruit and bricks at me. What I want to do in this talk is explain what the DNS Moda is, why it's been created, who's behind it, what it's going to do, what the potential members of it are, and what the plans and initial outline for this organisation are. I should say at this stage that this organisation has just been created, and a lot of stuff is fairly tentative in terms of policy and structure, how this thing is going to unfold. So we're giving you a snapshot of how we think this thing is going to unfold, but how it turns out to unfold will depend on the uptake and reaction of the community in general and the actual membership. So what's this all about? Well, for a long time now, we've had lots and lots of frustration at the IETF. And this is not as a personal criticism of any individuals at the IETF. It's really a problem of process and structure and organisation. And that's really been going on now for a long, long time. And the pattern I've seen at some of the IETF meetings, as I'm sure you've all seen, is that there's a flurry of drafts produced shortly before an IETF meeting. There's very little time for discussion when the actual IETF meeting takes place. Things are then said, let's take it back to the list. And then there's no traffic on the list until 2-3 weeks before the next IETF meeting. So the result is not a lot happens. We have another problem, is that whenever things do happen, they don't seem to get very far. DNSSEC. The IETF has been working on DNSSEC now for 10 years. Just over 10 years. We still don't have a completed standard. And there's a mountain of work in front of us for things like deployment, key management, key rollover. And the IETF is only beginning to grapple with that particular issue now. We have also the holy wars going on between the LLMNR people and the DHCPv6 community, and that battle has been going on and on and on, and there doesn't seem to be any kind of resolution to it. When other organisations try to input work into the IETF, they sometimes have difficulty gaining any kind of traction or engaging with IETF. Companies get told, go to this working group, and they go to that working group, and they're told, don't go here, go somewhere else. And they go somewhere else to be told, go back to where you first started. And then eventually, after a while of trying to figure this out, they don't get very far. I think fundamentally the problem at IETF is this volunteer effort model, because we're relying on the goodwill and support of a small number of individuals and a small number of companies. So in general terms, we could say if it wasn't for, if you like, the benevolence of companies like Sun and Cisco, a lot of stuff at the IETF simply would not happen because there's nobody there to do the work. And that workload is continuing to grow. We've also got the problem at the IESG for reviewing the draft standards. That is more than a full-time job, which someone is taking on in addition to the existing workload. So you have a problem there that whenever a draft standard is produced, it sometimes can't get any further because there's no second independent implementations. And even once that stuff's done, you then go to IESG, and then nothing happens afterwards because the ISG's got a backlog of work in front of them that takes up to 6 months. Give you an illustration of that, that I think it was at the previous WRITE meeting, but the one before that, the ENA working group had finished working on RFC 2916 BIS. The final version of that was approved just last week, so that was almost... Okay, thank you. So there's an indication of sort of timelines there. And if a company or an organisation is trying to build something or trying to get some stuff out of the process, they've got this unknown delay factor that they still have to take into their plans. And if you think things are bad in the DNS just now, they're going to get worse because there's stuff coming over the horizon. ENAM is going to make a big impact here. 3G telephony is going to make a big impact here, assuming these things really take off. And I think they will. Well, certainly ENAM will, in my opinion. There's other work to be done in the area of ad hoc networking, and this also takes back to this business with IPv6 and how you're going to locate your local name servers when you do plug-and-play type things. Then there's also this technology of RFID tags. So if every tin of soup in your supermarket has got an RFID tag on it, there could be a DNS lookup for that as you pass the checkout in order to actually compute your bill. And how those organisations that try to do some work or interact with the ITF, how are they going to get that stuff done? So, to be blunt, we can't wait for the ITF to reform itself. ITF recognises a problem there and is trying to deal with that problem. But what do we do meantime? Can we all just sit on our thumbs for the next 2 years or 3 years or however long it's going to take? We need something else for some definition of something else. And that should have a clear focus with dedicated efforts from engineering staff and competent experts in the field of DNS to produce work. And I think we've seen some kind of indication of where this can make a difference already. If you've noticed that the work in DNSSEC has greatly improved over the course of the last 6 months or so, because there are two people working full-time as the RFC document editors, not the RFC editors, but the document editors preparing the DNSSEC specifications. So because Rob Oystein and Scott Rose are fully funded to do that work, we're seeing things happen there. So it shows what can be done when people are working on this stuff full-time and they don't have other competing priorities in their day-to-day jobs. What hopefully we could also get out of this is also more predictable timely outcomes. People will know when some piece of work is likely to be finished if there's a clear project plan up front. So the suggestion that's been proposed is we create DNS MODA. Well, DNS MODA has been created. It's the DNS Manufacturers, Operators and Developers Association. So what is it? Well, in soundbite terms, it's W3C for the DNS. So we're going to set up another organisation which will work with the ITF to develop and progress DNS standards. Basic principles are it's going to be a fee-paying membership organisation. It will not be a not-for-profit, obviously. It will also be impartial and vendor-neutral. And it will employ staff to work on the DNS protocol. We will hire DNS engineers, people who've got a track record in this field, not some people we just drag off the street and put them down in front of the keyboard. So the idea is that these engineers will develop drafts, they'll produce tools potentially, best common practices, and may also provide alternate implementations. It's not a standards-making body.
Can you go back once? I really hope that there is only a soundbite version that is W3C for DNS, because W3C have real problems in the way their organization is set up. So I hope you're not copying that.
The question is,
learn from the existence of existing organizations, but not copying.
This is absolutely correct. We are learning from the model of it. The intention is not to copy and repeat the same mistakes that W3C may or may not have. as a fait accompli, a finished item of work. We're not about trying to fragment the DNS protocol either. We're not trying to impose or suggest or develop proprietary solutions or options. We're trying to produce stuff which is going to be accepted by industry as a whole. And everything that's produced by Moda will be in the public domain. So we're not trying to produce stuff that's then going to have some kind of license fee in order to get access to the standards. Who's behind it? Well, the three founding members are Autonomica. And for those who may not be aware, Autonomica is a company based in Stockholm that, amongst other things, takes care of the root server there. Internet Software Consortium is involved, and for those again who don't know, they run a root server too. WIDE is the research initiative in Japan. They run a root server too. And out of these organisations, a steering committee has been formed with representatives from each of those three companies or organisations, plus myself, and some other interested parties who we think will be able to give this organisation the kind of credibility that it deserves to have. And this is not going to be some organisation that's in the pockets of one of these founding organisations or companies, and the chair for the steering committee role will rotate between the founders for a while. And the current chair at the moment is Curtis Lindquist from Autonomica. And the idea is this steering committee will exist for as long enough until this organisation is fully up and running, members are established, and the membership can actually elect a council or a board to actually be the people that are responsible and accountable for the organisation itself. The immediate plan for year one is to have a budget of around about €800,000, and we'll employ six staff, three full-time engineers, one in each of the main centres, one in Japan, one in the United States, one in Europe. We'll have an outreach coordinator, some kind of exec director or figurehead, I don't know who that idiot's going to be, and then there'll be one administrative person to take care of all the day-to-day paperwork and stuff like that. And there's initial infrastructure support from the founders in terms of web access, bandwidth, mailing list support, and all that kind of thing, and further other incidental expenses, for example, to help with any legal costs involved in the setup of this thing. Growth is going to be self-funding and organic. So more staff will be hired as the membership grows, and also as the membership grows, the work that this organisation to undertake will increase, so therefore more staff is going to be needed. So broadly speaking, the membership teams will cover what this organisation is going to do, the members will decide what the organisation will do, and then the staff of Moda will work on this, although staff from Moda's members' companies and organisations could be seconded to also work on the projects and initiatives that Moda is working on. So what are the sort of areas of things that Moda could be working on? Again, this is just a provisional shopping list. So the sort of things we could be looking at are going to be in the areas surrounding DNSSEC deployment and migration. Likewise, similar kind of things with IPv6 deployment migration. What we're going to do about quad A glue records, that kind of idea. How we can make sure that the IPv6 folks don't get disconnected from the net whenever named servers are only IPv6 only or whatever. We could also do some things that are very, very simple in the first instance, best common practices in server placement and configuration. I've had some discussions with some phone companies to do with enum type things, and there's things like, well, we're going to have to deploy DNS in a bigger way to support all our telephone numbers, and then we're going to have the resolvers inside handsets and so on, having a trust relationship with some kind of name servers, which might be doing DNSSEC. How do we make an architecture for all that that hangs together? How can we write this down somewhere and give some kind of telecoms-wide way of agreed way of doing that? That's something that Moda could perhaps help with. Another area could be something very simple as documenting the practice, the protocol used by Nine for server management, for things like using RNDC, for instance. And maybe that could then be implemented and picked up by other name server implementations. So it's a common way of doing things like telling the name server to go and reload itself or reconfigure itself. Provisioning protocols could also be very useful, for example, for adding and removing zones, the sort of work that Olaf was just talking about with the reverse tree. There's a lot of provisioning work into configuring and set up the named.conf file. Perhaps some work could be done there to help with that. So these are just some suggestions of the possible things that this organisation could do. Who do we think is going to join? Well, the obvious candidates are things like the TLD registries, the big ISPs, the RIRs, some registrars, and the telcos. and we've had some discussions with a number of these companies, and there's a degree of interest there. Some are a little bit sceptical. No one so far has shot us down, although maybe that's going to happen quite soon, as soon as this presentation's finished. We've also got a lot of interest from hardware manufacturers, not just the computer manufacturers, but equipment manufacturers, the likes of, say, for example, router companies, that kind of thing. DNS software developers are another prime case in point. These companies really want to be involved in this thing to see what's going on there and make sure they can track any work that's involved, and also in some cases actually input things that they couldn't actually, weren't able to input through the ITF process perhaps. And perhaps later on down the road we may have governments and regulators get involved as soon as they start to realise that this DNS thing is important and there's interest for them there. We expect we'll also see uptake from membership organisations such as ETSI, the European Telecommunications Standards Institute. Centre could be involved there too, the 3G Forum, the GSM Association. And we also expect some interest from academic and research institutes such as potentially NLNet Labs and people like that. So, yours truly is on the payroll as employee number one. I'm the idiot that's sort of been put into this position of being sort of current pro tem exec director, stroke outreach director, stroke general factotum, stroke everything else. And pretty much it's, I've been told, it's your job, get this thing off the ground, go do it, make it happen. And I've crazily decided to accept this. So the initial idea is to do things like do some outreach, which is why I'm talking here today. Look at the area of recruitment, find out who we can get involved, both in terms of members, potential employees for this organisation, and perhaps produce some of the initial documents. And the first of those documents is going to be the simple things like business plans, the business justifications that companies and organisations will need to join and participate in MODA. So the plan is to recruit something like 6 to 8 members by the end of this year. We're going to hire full-time engineering staff, and we've got a number of staff already lined up in place. And as soon as we've got enough money to cover their salaries, they're going to be starting to work for MODA pretty much immediately. So as soon as we get enough members on board, these people will transfer their affiliations and start with MODA right away. Also, we have to start thinking, focusing on producing deliverables. So in the next 3 to 6 months, we'll actually produce some items of work to show to potential members that this is not some kind of Mickey Mouse academic exercise. There is some concrete grounding behind this. And this might be just very simple things like simple information on name server configuration and that sort of thing. Maybe so taking a smash of RSC 2182 and 2870, which is the latter one is root server placement, secondary name server placement is the issue that's taken in the form of the two. Taking these two things together and updating them because I think that it's time they were updated. How this is going to be governed, there'll be an executive committee which will be elected by the membership, and this will take care of all the usual policy type things, determine what the policy of the organisation is, its budget, fee structure and so on. An architecture committee will be drawn from the MODA's engineering staff and from the membership itself. This will oversee the technical work, make sure that deadlines are met and that projects are proceeding on schedule. They will determine the respective priorities and progress of those activities because there may be competing priorities within MODA itself, and may also involve liaison with external bodies. So this could be not only just things like IETF, it could involve other organisations such as, say, for example, ETSI or ITU, and liaison, for example, with, for example, BIPE would be another case in point, and perhaps NANOG and APRICOT, people like that. So the plan is we're going to get together a plan of advisory panel of well-known DNS experts. And their idea is to do a broad-reaching survey of what the sort of things that we need to start thinking about to progress the DNS. And they will ultimately come up with a more refined version of the work plan that I just presented a couple of slides ago. And the earliest DNS MODA members are going to be in the best position to actually influence that work because they can also give input into the drafting of this initial work plan or suggestion of topics the organisation takes on. Those might be coming from an unexpected source. We've already had some discussion with, surprisingly, a couple of large consumer electronics companies. They recognise that the future of audio and video is going to be over the internet. There was a discussion yesterday in the Scottish Borough that in Korea there's a lot of broadband penetration with high speed that people actually no longer renting videotapes in the video stores, they buy it over the net. So they get their videos and stuff that way. So anyway, these consumer electronics companies saying is, we want our televisions to be able to talk to some other manufacturers' hi-fi systems, which can also talk to some other manufacturers' fridges. So how are we going to make this work? Obviously, we give them IPv6 addresses. How are they going to talk to each other and find out the location of the servers and what's out there on the local area network? It's also related to the thing that Jordi was talking about yesterday in the IPv6 forum. So those people might be in the first in the driving seat to actually take things forward. What do we do if we don't do this? Well, we could do nothing and just continue with the status quo, but we're just going to continue on this rut. And I'm reminded of a saying that was by a British politician when there was a political problem some years ago. He said, the first rule is when you're in a hole, stop digging. Maybe it's time for the IETF to stop digging when it's in a particular hole. We could wait for the IETF reforming and restructuring to complete. How long is that going to take? Who knows? And even in this interim period, some other organisation is still probably going to be needed. I think this organisation is going to be needed one way or another. And if it's not going to be this DNS MODA, it's going to be something else. And that something else could be something that's not IETF compatible. It could be some kind of vendor association where a vendor or a couple of vendors get a consortium together with the idea of stitching up the DNS and taking stuff away from its core, open source, open, non-proprietary solution. That would not be nice. It could have a very narrow focus, so it may not be interesting, say, for example, DNSSEC, because as far as they're concerned, DNSSEC is nothing that they're particularly cared about. They may not have the same aims and aspirations as the overall internet community, whereas MODA, I think, will most definitely try to ensure that is the case. Okay, I now give my talk. I'm now going to take my lumps. Start throwing your rotten fruit, please. Nobody?
I have one...
Please state your name.
Rob Loxell, user of the DNS sometimes. I have one recommendation and one question. Recommendation to employee number one. I think you need a logo for your slides.
Oh, yes.
And question is, I would be very... interested in getting some reaction from IETF circles. I don't know whether there's anybody in the room right now who could give an indication. I assume you have been discussing this with...
Some background. This organization has been discussed, first of all, between the founding members for a fairly long time. So a number of people in the IETF are aware of this organisation's or the potential that an organisation like this was going to be created. And I have recently sent mail to Harald Alvestad, chair of the IETF, and although I'm not in a position to disclose the response, it was not unfavourable. But perhaps Jeff might want to have something else to say about that.
Jeff Houston, I sometimes play in the IAB.
Okay.
Maybe it's just the words you used, and maybe it's not your intent, but the words you used sounded quite alien to what the IETF actually does best, and to my mind would exacerbate our problems rather than fix them. Your exact words, as I recall, was, we will develop this and present to the IETF finished and complete solutions for standardisation. There's two things the IETF really hacks at badly. One, a half-baked lunatic idea that enters the room. It takes a lot of energy to throw it out again, and it sort of gets developed from a little half-baked idea into a huge half-baked idea, and it's still bad. What we also do really badly is get when we're presented with a fait accompli with possibly intellectual property rights behind it.
Right.
The IETF generally goes, we really don't like being treated like a rubber stamp. If you've got a contribution, make a contribution. But if you think that our major process here and the reason why we put all this weight and effort in here is to rubber stamp someone else's bound solution, then why are we doing this?
No.
Those were your words. So as I said, maybe it was presentation.
Yes, you're quite correct. It is the presentation. The object here is to engage with the IETF. I don't expect this organisation is going to come up with these crazy half-baked ideas because of the people that we're planning to hire. They're not idiots. However, I don't expect the more important point is this issue of treating the IETF as a rubber stamp. That is not what we're about. The idea, as I said, is to try and expedite the process by coming up with more or less, it will be certainly things which are closer to a completed item of work than going through the whole ITF process of draft after draft after draft. Now, it may well be, again, because this is a very early stage, how this is all going to work out, I frankly don't know, and it would be stupid of me to say so, but I don't see any reason why, as part of this process, rather than just have, you know, a final version appear from MODA and say to ITF, here you are, please endorse this, I would expect what could happen is that, in all likelihood, is earlier versions of those things would be coming to the ITF, so there's a two-way communication going on. I would see this more of a participation thing rather than just a rubber stamping exercise, and if I've given that impression, I was wrong.
Okay. Track record of the IETF in dealing with various forms of industry-based alliances and associations is really quite bad from both sides. We don't like overlapping and toe-treading. Memberships of various industry-based forums typically want to see benefit from paying their money.
Yep.
We don't like to work on the same piece of work as someone else. We actually like to understand what's our work and what's their work. Where we've had that overlap, and look at MPLS, the results have been erratic, unpredictable and half-baked and take even longer.
Yep.
So part of the risk you're going here is rather than helping the IETF in getting its problem solved, you're actually exacerbating the problem that makes the IETF so difficult, that folk tend to create other alliances and allegiances out there and come along with their solutions and say to the IETF, well, it's my way or no way.
Yep.
That kind of sort of blackmail into the IETF goes, well, you know, maybe there's our way as well. Well, and we'll spend more time wheel spinning.
That's true. I would also say that in the IETF, the precedents for organisations like this have been set in other contexts. I mean, W3C is one example of that, but also in things that...
W3C is not an example of this.
Of course.
In actual fact, some of those key protocols are no longer worked at by the IETF. Yep. We set up a dividing wall and said, yours, ours. You're not doing that here. You're actually trying to say, let's work together.
Exactly, yes. That's correct.
And that is a relatively novel concept in at least the last 10 years of the IETF. And if you pull it off, that's great. But I don't understand the mechanisms that the IETF will have to do to make you pull it, you know, allow us to pull it off.
Okay.
So I would like to close the queue after Curtis.
To be a little bit more precise, why W3C is not good and a good example. As Jeff was saying, there's a dividing line between what the IETF is doing and what the W3C is doing. The W3C is working with XML and HTML.
Yep.
IETF is working with HTTP.
Yep.
So and we have monthly conference calls where we are negotiating and making sure that we are never, ever working on the same document.
Yeah.
We have tried in a few cases and that didn't work.
Okay.
Okay. The other recommendations on problems they have with W3C has to do with wording on one of your slides, and that had to do with the result of the work is in the public domain.
Yes.
The question is how open is the actual what is the ability to give input to the work that is going on? Okay. And also together with the decision making process inside this organization. Those are two issues that, together with this public domain thing that you are claiming here, which is a little bit troublesome in an organization where members pay and would like to have something back.
Yeah.
So that is something that I recommend you to be much, much more clearer about when you do these kind of presentation, because that's one of the difference between whether this is good or whether this is bad. And also, if I take on my Cisco hat, that's also exactly what I told you, things that we at Cisco want to know very precisely before we are promising to pay anything.
Yeah.
We have no problem helping. It's a novel idea. We want Cisco, also want this standard, the DNS standards working. And if anyone has an idea on how to move forward, fine.
Yeah.
But we would like to be able to review whether that bird actually will fly.
Okay. Well, thank you, Patrick. I certainly welcome that kind of feedback. And this is part of the reason why this outreach program has started, because we want to engage in a dialogue to find out what people think about this organisation, the concepts behind it, and this issue of input into MODA from external bodies, output from MODA, and how this is also going to interact with the IETF, to pick back on the point that Jeff was raising before, is the sort of information that we would welcome particular feedback on. I can't give answers to those questions right now because, to some extent, this will depend on what the membership of MODA decides for itself, how it wants to do these things, because it's ultimately a membership organisation. And since at the moment we only have three founding members of this organisation, it's hard to see how this stuff is going to be worked out. And that's another challenge that I have to deal with over the course of the next year or so. Rob?
Yeah, I just want to emphasise what Patrick just said. In your presentation now, with all the recognizable criticism on the IETF, which you try to repair by doing this exercise, one, in my view, very important element of the whole process has disappeared, and that is the open, unconditional participation. Anybody can participate in an IETF working group. It's documented how to do it. It doesn't cost any money. The only thing you need to have is a working email address.
Yeah.
And you can participate. And I don't see that in your presentation. So you by trying to repair something, which we all agree it needs some better way of doing things, you... At least in the way you presented it today, you throw away something that is a very important element of the way we do things on the internet, which is also a very important element in our discussions with people who think they should regulate this, they should put governance on top of it. This complete openness is an extremely valuable element, and I would... recommend you to do some rethinking in that area of your planning.
Okay, thank you, Rob.
Sam Curtis Linkers. As I've been involved in this project for a while and in discussions, we actually thought about this for, I think, close to 6 months by now with various people. I think that this discussion got a bit too hung up on the interface with IETF and MODA, which is, I have to stress, is, you know, it's an important part of this, and it's very interesting. And we need to get the feedback too, but I think it's also worth remembering that DNS has come to a point where it's really critical for the operation of the internet, and there's a lot of services and people depending on this. And from talking to people around the world and large organizations during these 6 months, I think we come to the insight that this is actually a vacuum that is going to be filled one way or the other. People do see a need for an industry association to discuss these issues. And I think that this would have happened, either we do it or someone else do it, but it's clearly a huge interest by groups that I was surprised that I hadn't really thought of that would have an interest in this and who are clearly looking at this.
Yep.
And please, a short answer.
Yes, very, very short. I think that is what Jeff and I myself are saying as well. That if it is the case that you're creating an organization because it's really needed, because the IETF doesn't work, say so. Don't claim that you are working together with IETF. In that case, a decision has to be made. DNS protocol is no longer developed in the IETF or part of it. It is instead done in this other organization that works better. That's what Jeff and I myself is doing as well. So we are definitely not trying to protect the IETF and claim that the IETF has to do DNS for, like, eternity. Not at all.
No. I think another very important point I need to make here about MODA is that the people who are behind MODA and the people who have discussion recognise the importance of the DNS as a whole and the role that IETF has to play in this. DNS touches all these other protocols, the application areas, all these other things that to try and hive off or isolate the DNS from the IETF simply is not a starter. It's just not possible. It can't be done. And that's why MODA wants to work with IETF, have a collaborative relationship there so that things can be done, because we realise what comes out of MODA or what comes out of DNS protocol development generally is going to touch on other areas of the internet, and only by having that overview and the overriding experience of the input from the ISG and perhaps IAB and of the IETF community generally will get indications to where these things and the impact's going to be. And without that valuable assistance and feedback, any DNS organisation is not going to succeed anyway.
Okay, thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
Next speaker is David Malone with a report on Quad A measurement.
Okay, so this talk is just about a short series of experiments that I did to try and figure out people have done any web browsing over IPv6 will have often encountered various quirks that once their web browser is doing IPv6 lookups for domains that may have may know nothing about IPv6, sometimes problems run it, well, they encounter problems. And I would just want to try and quantify those problems to some extent. So the right thing that should happen if you make if you do a quad A lookup for a name that doesn't actually that exists but doesn't have a quad A record is that you should get back an answer saying there are zero quad A records for this name. However, there's a number of name servers that don't do that, and some of the problems have been listed in this draft up here. Possibly the worst outcome is that the name server returns NX domain, which is an indication that the domain doesn't exist. That result can then be cached by your local name server, and so when you go to do a lookup for an IPv4 address, it's cached the fact that the domain doesn't exist and returns immediately to you, oh, there's no such domain. So probably the most well-known example of that that's been around recently was ftp.perl.org, where if you used a FTP client that knew about doing, or a resolver library that knew about doing quad A lookups, you couldn't actually connect at all. It would say there was no such domain. The next problem that people usually see is that the name server just doesn't reply at all, in which case you have to wait for a timeout before you do your lookup for an A record. This is just plain annoying. It doesn't actually cause any real problems. It just means you have to sit there for 180 seconds or whatever waiting for all the DNS requests to timeout. The name server can return various other errors, such as not implemented. These don't actually tend to cause too much trouble because the name server will then, you just wait for a single request, you get an error back, and then you make another query for the A record, and that's not such a big problem. There were some reports of name servers that returned an A record when you asked for a quad A record, but they said it was a quad A record. So instead of returning a 128-bit address, they return a 32-bit address, and it's just interpreted as junk. Some name servers were also making various kind of lame delegations where they said, I don't know if that machine has a quad A record, but ask me and I might tell you. So the most common one, most common ones that actually seem to be reported, I guess because they're the only ones that users notice, are either a reply of NX domain or a timeout, because you really notice those. The diagnosis seems to be pretty tricky for end users. You have to sit there and you have to run lots of dig commands to try and figure out what the hell is going on. So I have a little CGI script there that you can put in a domain, and it asks each of the name servers for quad A records. You actually have to be slightly careful when you're doing this because you're dealing with broken name servers, you can't do all the queries you'd like. In many cases, these name servers don't just reject quad A lookups, they reject any lookup that isn't an A record. So this thing essentially keeps making requests for A records and looks at the glue to try and find out any other information it needs. So once I got the script, it was pretty easy to try and run it on a whole bunch of names to see, try and find out the extent of the problem. And so I got some proxy logs, dug out all the host names from them, and ran this script on each of the host names. These are the results by name. I don't really expect you to take in all the numbers. But the general gist of it is, this is how many names I tried doing the query on. This is a percentage of either actually having quad A records or various types of failures. These two sections here are blank because when I reran the survey in April, I found two new problems that hadn't been documented before. There's some name servers somewhere, not very many of them, that are returning refused when you ask for a quad A record. And there are two or three name servers that are returning error number 15, which as far as I can tell doesn't mean anything. It's some reserved error code. And this one is really very strange. It might be a misconfiguration because you only see that error if you make a non-recursive query for a quad A record. It seems to be very, very specific, so I'm not quite sure where it's coming from. But the order of the errors is kind of, this is the most common error, which is the timeout when you're asked for a quad A record, and that's 45 in 10,000 names are causing that. On the other hand, if you take that back and you look at it in terms of how many URLs from the proxy logs had names that had that problem, it's actually about 1.8% of them, because there are some very common names. Ad servers in particular seem to have this problem. So it's rather disappointing that the number of names that have problems is actually quite a lot bigger than the number of names that actually have Quad A records. This is a result where instead of summarising it by name, you summarise by name server to see how many machines we're actually looking at that need to be adjusted. Again, it's still the total number of machines that are having problems is only in the region of about 100, as far as I could see, from maybe 20,000 name servers that I managed to get in touch with. Again, it's of the order of maybe 50 and 100,000. I had to go running FPDNS, which I think this was spoken about at one of the previous meetings. Lorenzo suggested I have a go with it. And it's actually a relatively small number of different DNS servers seem to be causing the problem. These are the various signatures. There was a MyDNS one, a client DNS one, PowerDNS, several versions of Bind, and several unknown signatures. So if there's anybody, I keep meaning to get in touch with the FPDNS people to see if they can narrow down, are these actually versions of Bind, or is it some other signature, or some other server that has the same signature? So the conclusion of all this is that there's IPv6 users are still being tripped up by this problem. There's only a relatively small number of names and name servers affected, but you come across them quite a lot, so it does actually turn into an irritating problem. There are people working on it. There's the news.bbc.co.uk people fixed it very quickly. FTP.pearl.org fixed it once Mark Andrews explained to them what they had to do. DoubleClick is actually fixing their name servers. When I first did the survey, all of DoubleClick's name servers were busted, and now it's only about half of them. So I think they're gradually deploying a new load balancer. One question that I have is, should I try and let the owners of these name servers know in some way? As I know, scripts that go around and auto-nag people about your name server is broken, you should fix it, are very annoying. But I don't know whether people will find out if somebody doesn't nag them.
That's it. Thank you.
That's it.
So far, any questions?
Yeah. I think as far as the should we let people know, I think this is going to be another case of just like lame delegations that you may well be just, it's just not worth the effort, quite frankly. However, I do think that it would be a good idea to capture this information and document it. And I'm wondering maybe if what you might be willing to do is write this up to explain what the problem is, what is how to avoid it, and the sort of common configuration problems and the problems that result from it. And we could perhaps then adopt that as some kind of document that comes out of this working group, so that whenever you do or anyone does come across a site that does have this problem, they can be pointed at a document that explains why this is a bad thing and what they need to do to correct it.
Sure.
Any further questions? None? Then thanks, David, for the presentation and saving us some minutes. Next speaker is Jeff Houston about the reverse mapping for 6-4.
What am I looking at? Where's my... And what do I do if I can't see it? Plug in my machine?
I don't know. Did you upload your presentation?
I did, but I'll do it with Jim. I don't think Jim might.
So.
I'm going to go through this relatively quickly. What we're talking about here is the 6-4 space, the automatic tunneling, trying to do reverse delegation for those special constructed V6 addresses. This work has been done with George Michelson of APNIC and Andrei Robichevsky of Wright. What's the problem? To get isolated sites running V6 who only have native V4 connectivity locally connected, the 6-4 technique basically does auto address generation and tunneling. So you have some local site with some local addresses in V4, it doesn't really matter. But you have a V4 gateway and a 6-4 gateway
sitting in that edge box on your site, automatically that constructs synthesized addresses based on the external V4 address. The problem, how do you populate the reverse space with this? This is opportunistic low-scale networking. Anything that's expensive or high impact probably won't work. And anything that does inefficient name lookup probably won't work. And you're trying to get the cost of this particular operation put upon those who actually benefit from this. And you're also not trying to muck around with the DNS. Keith Moore did a draft on this. It explored some ideas that ranged from the vaguely reasonable to the insanely bizarre. But as a survey, it wasn't bad. The problem is that you can't just align yourself with the V4 delegation hierarchy, because the only reason why you're tunneling is that your upstream is not V6 aware. So why should they handle the reverse DNS hierarchies in this particular address space when they've got no other V6 infrastructure? So you may have to hop over delegations, and whoever's trying to do this manually now has to figure out, with absolutely no records or information, whether your request for reverse delegation is valid or not. It's guesswork, and really doesn't actually make any sense. Can we automate it? Well, you go and look down the V4 space and find the relevant servers, and then try and figure out, well, maybe they're doing the reverse V6 as well, so let's just aim queries at them. Apart from being a rather bizarre denial of service attack, I don't think it works. Can you just go and query a constructed address? In other words, alter the resolvers and reserve local addresses that whenever you don't find anything, you look for .1 or .2 or some other reserve number. Someone's definitely looking and clutching at straws. Fake the answer. After all, no one really populates reverse DNS anyway, do they? And those that do populate it with nonsense, so let's just put some more nonsense there and just create servers that synthesise. The comment, though, is if you're going to lie, I'm like, why bother lying? There's no point doing anything. So most of these things don't work. So somehow we need a standard delegation model, but somehow we need to put the work pressure back on the person requesting the delegation rather than the zone operator. So that's where we're coming in with this particular proposal. The proposal is that you delegate only at the 48-bit position, in other words, the equivalent of the gateway's /32 address. There's no hierarchy there. It's completely automated as a client-driven system, and you only let it be accessed in terms of delegatability if you're coming from a 6-to-4 address, and the only address you can manipulate in the reverse space is actually the address that you're coming from. So in other words, your source address on the transaction determines what domain you're actually working in terms of reverse delegation. So in details, that block only contains delegations for the /32s. That doesn't mean you have a flat file. You can internally make that file any structure you like, but the actual delegations outwards only occur at that /32v4 point. Secondly, they're performed without any human involvement. It's simply a web service that's only accessible in terms of performing delegation when you've actually strapped yourself up and are coming from that 6-to-4 address. A few little hints and kinks. The reason why you'd run it with HTTPS is to stop caching, amongst other things. You actually don't want any of these pages to get cached, so you want to know what the source address is. Any other connection attempts from any other address basically give you an FAQ so that you know vaguely why it's not working. And the issue is, what you really need to enter is the names of some domain name servers, and if you really want to also add to what's in the SOA field, you can add an email address as well. No usernames, no passwords, no context. If you come in and you're on a source address, that's what you can do. As usual, of course, at that point you would actually check the validity of the servers. If it's not going to work, don't do it. It's just a web page. Go fix the problem. Use the thing as a diagnostic tool. So it only works if everything is configured. And if you object to actually having type-ins, that's fine. It's pretty easy to strap the CGI and make it public. So if you like scripting directly at that, script directly at it. It's easy. The zone itself, relatively low TTL, incremental updates. The zone could, in theory, get large, although my intuitive feel is it won't, but some folk have a very different view. Let's say you're on DHCP, and the address you got was the address someone else already delegated some time back. Fine, make some changes. This is a stateless kind of thing. Whatever source address you come from, you can alter those delegation fields. The only caveat is that if the old contact address is lying around, they will be informed of the change. but after that their contact address has been overridden, any further changes won't go back. Garbage collection, if this gets stale, if you're done, your name servers break or go die or go away, there's basically a sweep. If you fail the sweep and don't respond to the error message, after another grace period, you have to go and do it again because the entry will get dropped. So again, this is totally automated. This is low cost, and that's the entire issue here. Who would bear this cost in any other mechanism? Because no one's really paying for this stuff. So fully automated. The real issue that we had in the other manual schemes was the hopover problem, that if my upstream in V4 doesn't actually have V6, how does the remote delegation engine know that I legitimately had that V4 space and I'm running a 64 gateway? This tries to get around that. Service delivery is rapid, and you can only change your own record. You can't change someone else's. That means that users either need to get given scripts to run from their 64 gateway vendor, or they have to go figure it out. But on the other hand, 64 always seems to me a bit of a hobbyist, self-driven thing, so maybe they'd prefer it. Issues. I'm actually running a little site, and my children like to play too. Will they muck around with this? Well, yes, they will. What can I do? Maybe I can put up a firewall? Maybe not, but it's my problem. It's not the delegation engine's problem. The delegation engine doesn't care. It's just the source address it works off. Mine are too old. the 64 client could inherit nonsense if you're using DHCP. Absolutely. To the extent that we use, rely and trust on reverse DNS to be correct, it's kind of hard to understand what the real problem here is. But if you think there's a problem and you're on a DHCP-based system, script an auto-update when you first get the address. If you're on a really short lease and you're running 64, why do you want to reverse it? Kind of bizarre. So in the corner cases with DHCP, I'm not even sure that you'd bother anyway through this. Someone can hijack a V4 address and put in fake 6-4 reverse entries. Look, if I hijack your V4 address, I don't give a stuff about your 6-4 reverse entries. I'm going to have more fun spoofing your identity for fun and profit. The reverse stuff really doesn't matter. I've got this sort of environment where I've got lots and lots and lots of 6-4 gateways that I need to maintain. The real answer is that 6-4 is a hack. Go and run V6. In other words, if this is a really big problem, maybe you're using the wrong solution. The DNS checking, when I enter in some DNS servers, the server machine goes and whacks DNS requests. And there's a scripted interface. In theory, I can generate a DOS attack at some other random machine. We will do throttling inside the model. So throttle the delegation requests and throttle the integrity checks, so that you don't try and do 2 million every second. That's where I am. Is this a reasonable approach? Mock-ups have been done in APNIC right now, and the full write-up is actually sitting there as a DNS, as an internet draft. It has had some review from the folk who originally invented 6-4, which is comforting, and so far it's still vaguely afloat. In other words, there's more hull than hole, but if you find some more holes, I'd be keen to hear from you. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Any questions?
Bernard, I didn't remind we discussed this draft in the last ITF.
This is an individual submission draft. It has not gone into a formal working group consideration. Okay. A pointer to the draft was sent to the DNS Ops and the V6 working group, and a number of comments were received by, firstly, Keith Moore and Brian Carpenter, and the ubiquitous Pekka Savoia.
Okay, good.
My English has been fixed up. I didn't realise I was so bad at English, but Pekka helps me.
Okay. I can't say anything about that. The other point is maybe more important. 6-4 first is a transition mechanism. At the moment, as far as I can see, a lot of people are deploying native IPv6. So why to provide a new mechanisms, probably with the danger to stick people in this experimental status of with tunnels everywhere or transition mechanisms everywhere?
I suppose I'm not arguing with 6-4. It's a fact of life that it's out there as a documented transition mechanism, and it's also a fact of life that there are deployed gateways that actually have implementations of this code. given that there has been a request coming into this kind of community, because we look after reverse delegations, to say, support it. And in looking at the manual mechanisms, it's kind of, why should the RIRs employ a number of staff and some cost to try and do this manually? And the next question is, well, could we just invest some work and a relatively small amount of work with some additional insecurity, and there is some, and just simply finesse this problem out as an automated system? So your question about is this a valid transition mechanism, Brian Carpenter and Keith Moore are the folk to address that too, and the V6Ops working group. But that's different to this. This is saying, given that it's there, given that it's being deployed, given that we're getting requests for reverse, what's the cleanest way to simply just mash out an automated solution that does this in a lightweight fashion? That's where this is aimed at.
Okay, thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
So we're running into the break, but if it is not this break, it will be the lunch break. So any objections that we continue with Andrei's talk? No objections. Thank you. So, Andrei, it's your turn. So we're going to hear about the reverse delegation or no more reverse delegation in IP6.int.
Okay. Well, my name is Andrei Rachevsky. I hope this presentation is not as controversial, so we are not running into the break too much. Well, what's the current status of reverse delegation in an ARPA zone with regards to IPv6 address space? This graph was provided by George Michelson from APNIC, so it shows the load in APNIC region. And you can see that, well, the load in ARPA is much higher than the load in INT. In our region, if you look at similar graphs, the load is not so much different, and it's very similar to the load of in zone as shown here in red line. And yes, this is only 3 queries per minute, or 3 to 4 queries per minute, which is almost 5 orders of magnitude lower than the query load for IPv4 reverse mapping. So what's underneath this graph? Well, almost 3 years ago, RFC 3152 declared IP6 ARPA zone as official reverse mapping place and deprecated use of IP6.n. Well, still, RIRs support both, and, well, in a different manner. Some of them just generate 2 zones from the same data set. Some of them, as RIPE-NTC, require separate reverse delegation requests. And there is Sixbone, which until now, reverse delegation for Sixbone space is only possible in IP6 in reverse delegation tree. But there is an RFC out there, and there are hopes that reverse delegation in ARPA zone will happen very soon. And of course, there are software development dependencies, and in some software, IP6.in tree is hard coded. Some software implements fallback mechanism one way or another. And as we see, there is still queries to int zone, so that means that software is treating int as first class. Some software treats int as first class reverse delegation tree. So, well, do we have a problem here? Well, first of all, there is no clear roadmap for IP6.in phase-out. RFC deprecates in, but doesn't specify how in should go away. There's certainly chicken and egg problem, because nothing breaks, so there is no incentive for software developers and system administrators to upgrade the code to develop new code. And while this legacy software is running out there, queries coming to these zones, which put pressure on areas to support both delegations. Well, yeah, until the zone is out there, it's hard to say if your software is broken or not. And that brings operational overhead in managing reverse. And sometimes this causes inconsistencies that are hard to debug. Well, a proposal. Well, as a first step, we suggest that areas freeze IP6.in zone, basically rejecting new delegations and rejecting modification to existing ones. That will inevitably cause gradual degradation of quality of IP6.in and at the same time gradual pressure increase on software developers and system administrators. At the next step, at some point of time, which can be declared by a decree or based on query load to in zone, remove existing delegations from IP6 in zone. And also we can think about removing in delegation altogether. Well, I think that should be seen as coordinated action, and if proposal makes sense, it should enter open policy process area, open policy process. And this is just initial step to gauge your feedback about this proposal. Publish the an internet draft to involve larger community, where to document the proposal and technical dependencies and technical consequences of removing this reverse tree. And coordinate involved six-bone community, definitely. And I think if we want to go this way, we better do this while the load is still low. And that's it. Any questions?
No one? Well, I have a question, if there's no one else. You suggested as part of your proposal to remove the IP6.in delegation. Do we know, or do you know, what influence that would have on the INT, on the load of the INT name service? Do you have a guess or a guesstimate?
Well, there are graphs about the load to in zone. So I think this load will move to, I mean, are you speaking about INT name service or root name service?
Well, you didn't suggest to delete the INT zone, but the IP6.INT zone, if it's deleted, all the old outdated software will still ask for the NS records that are down there in IP6.in. So
they might be coming from name servers that don't do negative caching. They might be coming from name servers that don't do negative caching.
Even if they do, the load will raise because negative caching TTL is lower usually.
Well, current load is 3 queries per minute, so it will not exceed this.
3 queries per minute?
Yeah, 3 to 4. Well, the same query load we see here at ns.ripe.net and APNIC is the same load. For in zone, it's about 3 to 4 queries per minute.
Seems like a non-problem.
Very quick question, Andre. You say there's some coordination needs to be done here. Who's actually going to do the coordination, and when's this internet draft going to be published? And if you'd answer that in 10 words so we can go and get some coffee, I'd appreciate it.
Well, to be honest, well, I don't know, but if the draft makes sense, we can work this out.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, that's it?
So, does it make sense? Does it not? Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Andre. Thanks for your patience and interest, and we will continue on at 11 sharp. Thanks. See you again.